It is Tuesday, October 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Myanmar may delay next month's election. Australia plans to take thousands of Syrian refugees. The international community honors a female science pioneer, and we hear about a new documentary on Nobel Peace Prize winning Malala Yousafzai. It's all ahead. Myanmar's Election Commission has asked the country's leadership to postpone next month's election. For more on this story, I'm joined by VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman, who's in Bangkok. Steve, has there been a decision yet made about the timing or changing the election in Myanmar?
If there's been a decision, it has not been announced publicly, but some politicians in Myanmar are anticipating that whether it's a matter of hours or days, that the Union Election Commission, that it is going to announce a delay for the polling, which had been scheduled for November 8th.
What is the reason for the delay?
Well, the Election Commission says that the polling should be delayed because of recent flooding, especially in a couple of regions that killed more than 100 people and, according to UN officials, has critically affected more than 1.5 million people. However, the NLD, the major party and the only party that's objecting to this, the opposition pro-democracy party led by Aung San Suu Kyi, says this is not a good enough excuse, noting that back in 2008, the constitutional referendum was held just a few days after a huge cyclone, Nargis, came through Myanmar, killing more than 100,000 people.
Well, I guess they are concerned that this is just a delaying tactic, perhaps, done to try to help the ruling party.
Well, there's certainly speculation that that is the reason, although most of the other parties, including some that are not favorable towards the military or the current government, have also agreed to go along with a delay in this election. So it is Aung San Suu Kyi's party is the only one that's hanging out there opposing this at this point.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve.
You're welcome, Sarah.
That is Steve Herman reporting from Bangkok. Well, looking at social media, I'm joined now by International Edition Susan Yaki. What are some of the leading news stories today, Susan?
Hi, Sarah. Well, there is much concern about the results of the Dutch-led investigation into the crash of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine in July of 2014. Good Morning Britain quotes a nephew of a victim as saying, "I don't think I will ever have closure." Bruno Bolpap writes, relatives of MH17 victims say they were told victims were immediately unconscious after missile impact. There are many tweets critical of any Russian role in the shootdown. And also at hashtag MH17, there are many touching photos, including some of the crash site and a flower and candle-strewn makeshift memorial. At voanews.com, our correspondent Carla Babb reports, the UN envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, is holding talks today in Russia as part of an effort to forge an understanding between Russian and U.S. officials and also move toward a political process to end the Syrian conflict. She notes de Mistura plans to fly later to Washington for talks there as well. There's also a report on the escalating violence in Israel. An article reports Israeli police say the death toll from a pair of separate stabbing and shooting attacks in Jerusalem has risen to 3. Authorities said one attack involved 2 people, shooting and stabbing passengers on a bus in Jerusalem, killing 2 and wounding at least 3 others.
Well, Susan, is there anything on social media about the Democrats' first debate?
Yes. In advance of tonight's debate among U.S. Democratic presidential hopefuls, there is the site hashtag BetterDebateQuestions. There, crusading Ivory Dev poses, if elected, will you pardon yourself on the first day? Elliot Hochberg suggests the question, who, in fact, let the dogs out, reminding us of that old song. And Vampire Mistress writes, Mr. Trump, where do you get your hair done? We just want to know so we don't screw up and accidentally go there. Although, Sarah, I don't think Donald Trump is sensitive about his hair. It's somewhat of a trademark now. Sarah, back to you.
I think you're right about that, Susan. That's International Edition Susan Yockey. Well, in other news, Australia has begun the task of selecting for resettlement 12,000 refugees from the crisis in Syria. It's expected that the first group will arrive before Christmas. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Sydney's Lakemba district is one of Australia's most multicultural areas. It's become a haven for a family from the Syrian city Homs that fled to Lebanon before arriving as refugees in Australia at the start of the year. Youssef Al-Kassay lives with his wife Hala and their three children, along with his mother, in a small rented house. Speaking through a translator, he says the horrors of what they left behind are always in their thoughts.
Life in Homs is very, very hard. No matter how much it tries to explain, it's very hard. There's killing all the time, people getting taken away. While they're taken away, they've been killed. Very hard to explain.
Youssef says he was detained and tortured by government officials.
He was taken away and he suffered a lot, hit a lot, and he suffered very hard, not only physically but also the mental trauma he went through. He has a lot of family and friends, a lot that have died.
His wife Hala is happy to be in Australia, but she too worries about those left behind.
She has a lot of family and friends in Syria, a lot, and she's very, very afraid of how they're living. They have no food, no electricity. The life is very, very hard, and she's constantly worried.
We should be so proud of ourselves standing here tonight with courage and compassion to say welcome. One, two, three. Hopefully our politicians are listening.
Rallies urging Australia to take in more of those fleeing the conflict in Syria have been held across the country. More than half of the 12,000 refugees will be resettled in New South Wales, the nation's most populous state. Displaced women, children and families living in camps in Jordan, Lebanon and Turkey will be given priority. Coordinating plans for their arrival is Professor Peter Schergold, an academic and businessman.
It's possible that compared to many refugee groups accepted in the past, these newcomers may have spent less time in refugee camps. They may be more likely, I think, to be educated, have trade and professional skills, have had experience in small business, be more likely to have at least rudimentary English. And of course, therefore, the challenge, and it's the vital challenge, is how can we harness that education, those skills, so that they can contribute back to Australian society.
Youssef and his family listen to a song that laments Syria's descent into chaos and the killing of the innocent. They hope that more of their countrymen and women will follow them to safety in Australia, which will give preference to refugees from persecuted minorities. Samar Al-Madzoub, a Syrian community activist, believes Australia should do more and open its doors to members of the Sunni majority.
We need more refugees. I think this is a small number. The people who are suffering there, very, very big number. The minority people there not suffering as much as the Sunni people and the larger group of people there.
Australian resettlement officials are now in Jordan to begin assessing Syrian refugees who've been living in camps. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Did you know that elephants rarely get cancer? Why these giant creatures are better equipped to avoid this dreaded disease has mystified scientists for years. Deepening the mystery further is that elephants have 100 times as many cells as humans, which should also boost the odds of having at least one of those many cells mutate into a cancerous state. Researchers at the Huntsman Cancer Institute and the Ringling Brothers Center for Elephant Conservation say they may have the answer. The scientists found that elephants have 38 additional copies of a modified gene that programs a well-known tumor-suppressing protein called P53. The researchers believe that the elephants may also have a much stronger system for destroying damaged cells that could become cancerous. But further research is needed to confirm this. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new documentary explores the life of a Pakistani teenager who went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Today is Ada Lovelace Day, an international celebration of women in science. It's named for the 19th century female scientific pioneer. I spoke with Sue Charman Anderson, who founded the day in 2009. She joins me on the line from the United Kingdom. Who was Ada Lovelace, and why is she important to, particularly to young engineers, young women engineers today?
So Ada Lovelace is often called the first computer programmer, and she really was a visionary when it came to imagining how important a computer could be and what sorts of things a computer could do. But she was actually the daughter of Lord Byron, the Romantic poet, and Annabella Milbank, Baroness Wentworth. So she was born actually 200 years ago this year. And you might think that the Victorians wouldn't have a computer for her to think about, but in actual fact, Charles Babbage was a good friend of Ada Lovelace's, and he had invented a mechanical clockwork computer called the analytical engine. And Ada was absolutely fascinated by this and became an expert in how it might work. And she wrote a program to calculate Bernoulli numbers, but she also saw that a general purpose computing machine, if it could be programmed with the right data and algorithms, could be used to create art and music, which was an absolutely huge leap, conceptual leap at that point, because they didn't have that kind of a concept of a machine. Machines could do what you told them to do and nothing more. So she's really a great figurehead because she really was in 100 years ahead of her time. Her work wasn't recognized until the 1940s when Alan Turing discovered it. So she really is an important figure in the history of computing. But, you know, as a woman and as a very early computer visionary, she has often been overlooked.
Yes, and how much education was she able to have, particularly at that time?
Well, this was definitely an era where women didn't get an education, but her mother, Annabella, was very keen on maths. She'd been educated by Cambridge professors in maths and science. And there was a real fear that Annabella had that Ada would inherit her father's poetic tendencies. So she had her daughter schooled in maths and science in order to try and impose some rigor of thought, so that Ada wouldn't kind of run away with a Byronic poetic personality. And yeah, actually, you know, Ada did inherit quite a lot of her personality from her father, and she was actually quite poetic, but she saw maths as the poetical science.
Well, now you were the founder of this day back in 2009. Why do you think that it is so important for modern day, for future generations to know about Ada Lovelace?
I think for me, Ada is an amazing figurehead. She's a woman that I can relate to in terms of, you know, how excited she would get about science and math. But Ada Lovelace Day really is about all women in STEM, in science, technology, engineering, and math. And it's really about celebrating women whose stories haven't been told and re-examining some familiar faces, perhaps, whose stories have been edited over the years. People like Florence Nightingale, who is seen as the woman who professionalized nursing, which she did, but she was also an amazing statistician, and she invented the polar area graph, which is a type of pie chart. So her statistics work is often overlooked because people see her as, you know, the caring nurse. So it's really about kind of reassessing the history of women in STEM and also looking at what women are doing today.
Yes, an enormous amount. And also how this is impacting women living in developing countries that ordinarily might not have been able to pursue science.
Yes, this year we actually have, I think it's now 135 independent Ada Lovelace Day events happening around the world. And we have at least one event on every continent. So we've got a couple in Africa, we've got some in Asia, Australia. We've even got an event in Antarctica. So it really is about giving people an opportunity and encouraging people to put on events that serve their local community. And we get all sorts of different types of events. You know, some of them are, you know, more traditional talks and presentations. There's lots of Wikipedia editathons, and we get art exhibitions and all kinds of stuff. So it's a really fun day to get involved in something that really is a global celebration.
Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It's been a pleasure.
That is Sue Charman Anderson. She is the founder of Ada Lovelace Day. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Davis Guggenheim's documentary, He Named Me Malala, offers a probing look into the life of 18-year-old Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani teenager who, in 2012, was shot in the head by the Taliban for standing up for her rights to education in her hometown in Pakistan's Swat Valley. Guggenheim shows how, since then, Malala has become a symbol, not as a victim of brutal violence, but as an advocate for girls' education throughout the world. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more. We seem to be having technical difficulties at the moment. We will come back to that piece as soon as possible.
To understand Malala's personality and inner power, Davis Guggenheim explores her family dynamics, especially her bond with her dad.
When she was very small, many friends used to come to our home. We used to talk about politics, we used to talk about the basic rights, and she used to sit with us.
When I was younger, I used to listen to him. Like, what is he saying, how he talks?
Davis Guggenheim says that Malala's life was almost prescribed from the moment her father, himself an activist, named her after a 19th century Afghan folk heroine.
She was inspired by the girl she was named after, the Malala of Mewand, that girl who spoke out for what she believed and rallied the Afghan troops to defeat the British.
The film also shows that after Malala was shot, her father was devastated because he felt responsible for raising her with ideas that endangered her life. But Malala thinks otherwise.
My father only gave me the name Malala. He didn't make me Malala.
Still, the film raises the question, what formed Malala into the person she is today?
I chose this life.
Who would you have been if you were just an ordinary girl from the Swat Valley?
If I was an ordinary girl in Swat Valley, I'm still an ordinary girl. But if I had an ordinary father and an ordinary mother and our family, a conservative family, then I would have two children now.
After a slow and painful recovery, Malala made it her goal to rally for girls' education the world over. Guggenheim describes her as fearless.
Malala, you know, speaks to world leaders. We were in Nigeria when the girls had been kidnapped for a long period of time, and she insisted to sit down with President Goodluck Jonathan and said, "What are you doing about these girls? It's your job to get them released." She met President Obama and asked him about drone strikes.
Nobel Peace Prize is to be awarded to Malala Yousafzai.
That fearlessness and her message brought her the Nobel Peace Prize in 2014.
She is something to teach the world, not just because she was a girl who was shot on the school bus, not just because of her advocacy work, but because she has a very, very deep soul. She's a very spiritual person, and I think she has a strong voice that speaks to a lot of people who are voiceless.
I tell my story not because it is unique. It is the story of many girls. We realize the importance of light when we see darkness, the importance of our voice when we are silenced. Let us pick up our books and our pens. They are our most powerful weapons.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
That documentary is a look at the life of Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.